From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Walter Curran was a crusader for the Mormon Church. He was 12 when missionaries came to the door and converted his family. Now he's trying to figure out what appealed to him about religion and why he got out. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Walter Curran about religion and about his new novel. It's about a right-to-life activist and a woman he's trying to prevent from having an abortion. They fall in love. Also today, coming to America, we meet Czech emigre Ivar Pekarková, a New York City cab driver who's written a new road novel. And music inspired by presidential campaigns, past and present, from critics Lloyd Schwartz and Ken Tucker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Bush and Clinton campaigns will meet tonight in Washington to discuss plans for a series of presidential debates. The announcement came after a day of maneuvering by both camps. The Bush campaign chairman, Robert Teeter, will meet tonight with Clinton chairman, Mickey Cantor, at Cantor's law offices. Earlier today, the Bush camp offered to meet Clinton aides any place, any time, but then backed down after the Clinton side called for meeting at the offices of the Bipartisan Commission on Debates. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the Bush campaign objected to bringing the Bipartisan Commission back into the process. Bill Clinton said that he's authorized his representatives to talk first with the commission, then with Bush negotiators. The two presidential campaigns are still offering very different proposals for when debates should occur. NPR's Ira Glass reports.
Right now, the president wants four debates on Sundays, starting in 2 weeks. Governor Clinton says that they should stick with the two debates already scheduled for this Sunday and for Thursday the 15th.
The president says, let's get on with it. And then he says, but let's wait 2 weeks. And let's have these debates in conflict with the World Series or something else where we're not even sure all the networks will cover them. And at times when we're not sure the West Coast will fully see it.
Clinton today declared victory at getting George Bush to at last agree to debate. The president said that Clinton should use less rhetoric, less posturing, and accept his proposal. I'm Ira Glass reporting.
Security was stepped up in Luanda, the capital of Angola, today, the second and final day of that country's first democratic elections. NPR's Suni Khalid reports that the situation remains calm as Angola waits for final election results.
Angolan election officials reported that voter turnout tapered off on the second day of balloting in multi-party elections. Despite sporadic campaign violence, no incidents have been reported so far at the country's 5,000 polling stations. About half of Angola's 5 million registered voters cast ballots on the first day of United Nations monitored polling. 18 political parties and 12 presidential candidates are vying for power. But most observers view the elections as a contest between the former Soviet-backed ruling party and a former rebel movement, which was backed until recently by the United States. A ceasefire between the two sides ended a 16-year civil war and led to this week's elections. President José Eduardo dos Santos and former rebel leader Jonas Savimbi have pledged to accept the final election results from the National Election Council. Those results are expected by Friday. I'm Suni Khalid in Luanda, Angola.
Stock prices closed slightly higher today despite reports of an unexpected plunge in new home sales in August. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 5 points to close at 3,271.7. Advances led declines by a slight margin. This is NPR News. The leaders of Britain and France have reaffirmed their commitment to keeping all 12 members of the European Community together as an economic and political force. Prime Minister John Major met today with President François Mitterrand in Paris. Major said the two had agreed on changes designed to keep the EC countries moving together. The changes would include a more open decision-making process, protection for national identities, and measures to keep the EC from interfering in national responsibilities. The two leaders called for ratification and implementation of the Maastricht Treaty on European Union, but they didn't mention Britain's demands for a reform of the European currency system. More than 5,000 Palestinian prisoners have been on a hunger strike for the last 4 days to protest conditions in Israeli jails. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The hunger strike has now spread to Palestinians in every prison that they are held. The detainees are drinking liquids, but they are refusing food. They say that prison conditions have deteriorated and are calling for better food, freedom of movement between cells, and an independent investigation into violence and harassment by guards. Families of prisoners have also begun a sit-down strike in front of several Red Cross offices in the territories. Palestinian sources say the strike was ordered by PLO leader Yasser Arafat, who is dissatisfied with the lack of progress in the most recent round of peace talks in Washington. Palestinians who oppose the peace process are also using the prison strike to unite the opposition. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The tiny Persian Gulf state of Qatar says that Saudi troops attacked one of its border posts today, killing two soldiers and capturing a third. Qatar's news agency said the motivation for the attack wasn't immediately known. Saudi Arabia had no immediate comment, but the report from Qatar said that the Saudi government sent a message to Qatar's crown prince shortly after the attack. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Walter Kern writes, "When you can see things others can't, children in the womb, the hand of God, they call you a fanatic, but you know better what you are. A person with a vision." That's from Kern's new novel, She Needed Me. It's written from the point of view of a young man who has joined a cult-like anti-abortion group called the Conscience Squad. He falls in love with a woman he's trying to prevent from having an abortion. Kern describes this as a novel about religion and redemption. And he writes about religion in all of its most unusual contemporary manifestations, including cable TV shows and Christian cosmetics companies that sell door-to-door. Kern grew up in a Mormon family in a Lutheran town in Minnesota. She Needed Me is his first novel. He writes for many magazines and is a media critic for Mirabella. Before we talk with Kern, here he is reading from the opening of his novel.
As members of the Conscience Squad, we kept ourselves in a constant state of readiness, sleeping lightly, shoes beside our beds. We never knew when the call would come. A few of us, myself included, had lost good jobs because of this, not even having time to call in sick as we hustled into our clothes and out the door. On mornings when the school bus came, minutes mattered, excuses could wait. Lucas would honk the horn once, that's all. A second honk could rouse the neighbors, any of whom might warn the other side. If a person wanted breakfast, the school bus carried tea and donuts. Sometimes, on long trips, Lucas stopped at Burger King and ordered us malts and whoppers. Myself, I was usually too wound up to eat. My job was distributing the literature, snipping the twine on the heavy bales of pamphlets and passing them around to members before we reached the Target clinic. The slicker handouts, the ones with color photos showing the disturbing, bloody truth of what our opponents called the procedure, were obtained from a national clearinghouse in Georgia. The tracts that were made up of Bible verses and quotes from remorseful abortionists we produced ourselves. For its boldness and disciplined organization, the Conscience Squad had received citations from public figures too numerous to name, including a Catholic archbishop and a U.S. senator. It was the first group I had been a part of that actually stood for something, some idea. There were rumors that even the governor supported us, although his advisors would not let him say so for fear of offending liberal special interests. I was very proud to be a member.
Walter Kern, the main character in your novel is Weaver Walquist, and I wonder if he's somebody who you think you might have become at some point?
I think he was someone I was briefly, and someone my brother was. I grew up a Mormon, and like Weaver, I had a very set idea as a teenager about what was right and wrong. You know, it's amazing how young people can be more judgmental than any other age group. And I was a very young, rigid, Republican, religious type at one time.
Was there something you really wanted to understand by writing this book?
Yeah, there was. I, first of all, in writing about a member of the so-called religious right, wanted to understand a group which I think is barely described in any of our popular culture. And I wanted to understand what its appeal had been to me personally, because I was I was an eager beaver as a Mormon. I was ready to convert the world, and I wanted to understand how I got into it and how I got out of it, because I did get out of it. If anything, I'm a member of the media elite now rather than a Mormon, which is a strange transformation.
Your parents were Mormons?
We were converted. There's a story in my first book which is oddly biographical in that it seems too strange for reality, but Mormons came to the door one day, knocked, my father let them in, and they virtually took over our lives with our permission. We were in a fairly screwed up familial situation, and they solved our problems for us and made us members of their church, and I don't know whether or not I look back on it fondly or not. I just remember it as an amazing transformation.
How old were you?
12, 13 years old.
What were the big problems in the family, and what did the Mormon Church do to change them?
Well, we use the word dysfunctional now, and I suppose that every behavior we put under the heading of dysfunctional, my family was suffering from. There was drinking, there was fighting between the parents, there was fighting between the kids, and all of a sudden it was as though the angel of God came down to bring peace to us. As these religious people can do, they really have the ability to change people's lives, at least briefly, and that's why they're so successful.
So as a young Mormon boy, what did you do to be active in the church? What was new in your life?
Oh, you have to become literate in a whole new tradition, especially if you've come from a sort of secular, unreligious background. You start reading the Bible. You start entering contests concerning your knowledge of the Bible. You start regulating your behavior in a new way, your sexual behavior. For example, as a teenager, there were a lot of strictures on my behavior, which I happily agreed and went along with. And going to be in a group every weekend, I think that was the biggest change. You know, Americans are more and more not in groups and do everything by themselves at home. And suddenly we were going to sit in a room every week with hundreds of people, and not just once a week, but several times a week. And they were my family, I was told. And I hadn't had a family that big before, and I can tell you it was an interesting and refreshing change from the sort of isolation of the suburban nuclear family into this great ecstatic group of people. Oh, boy, I didn't even want to watch television.
Now, in the area where you grew up in Minnesota, I think it was predominantly Lutheran?
Yeah.
So were you considered kind of freakish being Mormon in a predominantly Lutheran area?
Well, we were converted during a brief stay in Phoenix, Arizona, and we came back with our Mormonism on our back. It's a kind of a Western, more than a Midwestern religion, and we continued to practice it in Minnesota, but it was strange. Whereas the Mormons had been a majority in a way, or at least a huge group in Phoenix, they were a tiny, struggling minority in Minnesota, and it was never quite the same once we moved back. That sense of being connected to everyone went away, and I felt like we were a group of freaks, misunderstood, disliked.
You were 12 when your family was converted to and became Mormons, so just about the point that you were going through puberty, your family becomes very religious.
At precisely the point. Sometimes I think it was a conspiracy to prevent me from using my newfound hormones.
Well, you have a story in your first book, a collection of short stories called My Hard Bargain. And the first story in there, called Planetarium, is a story about a young man who's just going through puberty, and he stimulates himself a lot, and he knows from the sermons in church that this is a He knows from the bishop that this is very bad, and he confesses to it, and he's shocked to find out that he knows the exact number of times he's done it, because he can mention that precisely.
to the bishop. But the bishop tells him and tells all the boys to kind of keep track of how many times they stimulate themselves and to write an X in invisible ink that can only be seen in ultraviolet light. And at the end of the story, he puts up everybody's X's and turns on the ultraviolet light, and the whole the whole like ceiling is lit up with X's. And I guess reading that, I just couldn't help but wonder if you were asked to do anything like that ever.
What I was asked to do in real life to end my habit of self-stimulation was much more gruesome than that story records. A Mormon bishop told me, he asked me if I did this. I said yes. And he said, well, do you imagine a beautiful woman while you're stimulating yourself? And I said, in fact, I do. And he said, well, I want you to imagine her differently. I want you to imagine that she has a terrible wound and is bleeding. And every time you see that, you'll want to stop stimulating yourself. And I went back and was stupid enough to actually try this program. I have no idea what harm it's caused me since.
That's really strange.
It's truly strange. I mean, the strangest things happen in the plainest boxes, Mormon churches and Midwestern small towns. That's been my experience. The cities are hives of conformism compared to the bizarre outgrowths of behavior that happen in the Midwest.
Yeah, well, let me quote something from your book, the town that the main character comes from. He says, underneath the small town, there were secret passageways with doors that opened on strange, illicit places.
Small towns are like stage sets, and I speak from experience. I live in one now, and I grew up in them. And they're all about putting out appearances to the neighbors. And once that's done, all heck breaks loose behind the closed doors. And oh, I remember in the town I grew up in, Minnesota, there was illegal gambling. There were more drugs than I've ever seen since. There was sex, sometimes incest, practiced quite openly. You know, out west you have polygamous communities. Not many people know about them, but there are quite a few. Small town life is like opening a trap door and getting down in the root cellar. Strange things happen down there.
What were the sins that you were most afraid of as you were coming of age in a new religion?
Every single one of them, really. I mean, it was as though you were just surrounded by pits, and you could hardly take a step without falling into one of them. In the bishop's interview that they give you every month as a Mormon, they always ask you first, have you committed murder? Which seemed so strange to me as a 13-year-old that I could be suspected of murder. But I realized that I was suspected of absolutely everything just by virtue of being a sinful human being. And that's what's funny about religion, is it usually doesn't make much distinction between smoking a cigarette, which is illegal in Mormon theology, and committing murder. Just as it doesn't make a distinction between having an abortion and committing murder. It tends to get the trivial behaviors mixed up with the profound ones.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Walter Kern. He has a new novel called She Needed Me, and the novel is about a young man in an anti-abortion group called the Conscience Squad who tries to talk a young woman out of an abortion, and they end up on the road together. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Walter Kern is my guest, author of the new novel, She Needed Me. In your novel, the young man who becomes a member of the Conscience Squad, the Right to Life group, before he becomes converted and before he becomes a member of this group, he was a pretty wild teenager, a lot of drugs and alcohol. He and his friends would take off and write 666 with spray paint on walls. And would write destruction with a K. And what else would they write? The beast be with us, Satan rises. So he goes from that into becoming a member of this group, the Conscience Squad. Did the opposite happen to you? Did you, after coming of age as a Mormon, then end up with spray paint writing the beast be with us?
I never wrote those words. They were my wilder friends who that character is based on. You know, small town Satanism does exist. I mean, it's cuckoo, and it's kids imitating something they've heard about, but it's real. It's a strange attempt at protest that goes on in religious communities. Hey, the only rebel you've ever had portrayed to you is the devil, so when it's time to rebel, you use your idea of the devil to do it, and it's, you know, it's comic in a way, but it exists. It's out there.
Did you listen to heavy metal music?
Yeah, I listened to heavy metal music. I tried to hear the subtle hidden messages urging me to suicide. I already knew that it was forbidden. I mean, you know, it's one of those forbidden fruits that takes on extra luster. And I loved heavy metal music. Most small town kids do, really, at some point in their life. It's all about ecstasy and breaking free and, you know, ruling the universe and dominating women if you're a man and everything you think you want at 16.
So the devil iconography really had this power.
Well, I think people underestimate the extent to which a lot of Americans see history still as this struggle between God and the devil, just that literally. I know that, you know, there are whole groups of people who base their entire way of life on this thesis all over America, not just in the Midwest. We're not the progressive, shiny, secular society we sometimes think of ourselves once you scratch the surface.
So when you were listening to heavy metal music, were you still a Mormon or had you left the fold?
I think I was on my way out. I mean, but you have to be a Mormon to be interested in the devil. You have to be religious to be interested in the devil. And so I guess it was the transition point. But it's scary. I mean, heavy metal music listened to over headphones with your eyes closed while high on marijuana is a pretty harrowing experience, and in my book, the character just can't take it.
So when you left Minnesota,
yeah,
and went to Princeton to go to college, how did your life change?
It was probably, it was both liberating and excruciatingly alienating to go from Schaefer, Minnesota, population 500, to Princeton University, home of the I don't know, the elite, really. That's everyone seemed smarter, better dressed, more beautiful, as though they knew where the levers were that operated the world, and I had no clue. I was watching, I felt like a guest at a country club. I felt like I had a day pass at a country club, and the security guard would come make me leave.
Can you be close to your parents after you've left the religion that they're still in?
As a matter of fact, my parents left the religion before I did. It was fun for me. I stayed in it because it was a wonderful group of young people, people to hang out with, people to listen to heavy metal music at night with. My parents, who had joined the church to sort of, I think, heal a very painful time in their lives, once that was healed, were no longer interested. A lot of people drift in and out of religion, be it New Age or, you know, more traditional.
Well, I'm trying to think of how confused they must have been. If they left the church and you stayed in it, but while you were in it, you were listening to heavy metal music about the devil with a lot of other Mormon teenagers. I mean, it's
that was our night side.
Uh-huh.
During the day, we wore white shirts.
Uh-huh.
It's hard to explain how complex life gets when you supercharge it with good and evil, which is, and think about good and evil all the time. You know, you just end up living a topsy-turvy life.
So how did you actually finally split from the church?
I realized that it was in Mormonism, it's mandatory pretty much that at 18 a young man go on a mission for 2 years, spread the gospel. I wanted an education. I wanted to be a writer by that time, and they gave me a choice, and I took the education.
They gave you a choice of...
Between going on a mission and going to Princeton, basically.
Oh, and that would have been acceptable within the religion? Or did going to Princeton mean that you were leaving?
Going to Princeton, most Mormons at 18 go off and become missionaries for 2 years and then go to college. I wanted to go to college as soon as I possibly could.
So that decision meant you were out?
Basically.
When you left the Mormons, which is a very disciplined group, did you feel a void in your life? Okay, you found education, you were at Princeton, but suddenly this like structure wasn't there anymore. Did you look for that in something else?
I looked for it in writing, really, and studying. Luckily, being a Mormon had taught me to study. You got up at 6 in the morning to read the Book of Mormon and the Bible. That's a very good habit to get into if you want to be a writer. I've kept many of the same habits I had. I've changed my beliefs somewhat. And there was no real void. I mean, the figures of literature were at least as inspiring to me as the Mormon saints.
I'm tempted to ask you your impression of New Age groups and the function that you think they're playing in contemporary culture, because you touch on that in your novel too, and as the main character, he once tried something called ergonics and Aquarian rebirth, and he says he wanted to be in the place where everyone looked like movie stars without having movie stars problems.
Well, that's what the New Age seems to promise, as far as I can tell. I'm no authority on it. What I do know is that a lot of people go back and forth between the New Age and more traditional Christianity. This is not two separate groups of people. There is one great group of seekers in American life, and they shop at all the markets. The New Age is one of the religious markets. It strikes me as not being new in any way. As far as I know, since the founding of America, think positive, grow rich has been... the underlying philosophy of the majority.
Do you feel that there's anything in your writing that you are in the middle of working through right now?
I'm at one of those odd, vulnerable times for a writer when my life and work totally confused. My relationships with women are totally confused, which is probably why I want to write about polygamy. An old-fashioned solution to a very modern problem, which is our inability to stay with one person exclusively. And I pretty nakedly try to work out my own problems in my books. You know, you don't get paid enough to write books to make it worthwhile for any other reason except as a kind of therapy.
Walter Kern, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Okay, thanks.
Walter Kern's new novel is called She Needed Me. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Czechoslovakia couldn't hold Eva Pekárková. As soon as she could, she left her native country. Now she's driving a cab in New York City, dodging traffic and the questions of curious passengers. She's written a new road novel called Truck Stop Rainbows. Coming up, we meet her. And music critics Lloyd Schwartz and Ken Tucker play records inspired by past and present presidential campaigns. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. After a day of traded charges between the Bush and Clinton camps on the question of presidential debates, a first step is being taken this evening to set times and places. Both campaigns say that top aides will meet in Washington. Involved in tonight's meeting are Bush campaign chairman Robert Teeter and Clinton campaign chairman Mickey Cantor. According to a Clinton spokeswoman, the Arkansas governor is willing to accept four debates as proposed by President Bush, but they need to work out the best times. Mr. Bush has proposed four Sunday nights, but Clinton said this could pose a conflict with World Series games that might rule out West Coast television audiences. The Bush administration is prepared to resume flights of food and medicine to Bosnia. Relief flights were suspended almost 1 month ago, after an Italian plane was shot down. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
There have been general assurances from all the parties they will not attack the planes, but U.S. officials acknowledge relief flights remain extremely risky, and relief flights alone will not be enough to stop widespread starvation. Officials say new land corridors must be opened. U.S. and U.N. officials are warning that winter weather could lead to well over 100,000 deaths in Bosnia if assistance isn't increased. The UN voted to expand the number of troops on the ground protecting the shipments, but they may not reach the region for another month or two, too late to be of help, according to some officials. The United States has not offered ground troops, but is offering to airlift forces from other countries in order to cut down on the time needed to get them in. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
During this summer's International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam, routine proceedings were interrupted by dramatic reports of the possible discovery of a third AIDS virus. The World Health Organization ordered an investigation, and as NPR's Patricia Naiman reports, has released its findings.
WHO officials say there is no evidence of a new AIDS virus. The International Health Organization had asked laboratories throughout the world to report findings of such a virus. After a two-day meeting with 22 AIDS experts, WHO officials say that AIDS-like immune deficiencies were reported in 100 cases worldwide in patients who tested negative for HIV, the AIDS virus. WHO AIDS Director Dr. Michael Merson said most of the immune deficiencies were caused by other conditions, including cancer, tuberculosis, drug abuse, and genetic defect. Even so, Merson called for more research just to make sure no new contagious disease has developed. In Los Angeles, I'm Patricia Naiman reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 5 points to close at 3,271.66. This is NPR News. On Capitol Hill, the House has failed to override President Bush's veto of a bill requiring many businesses to give their workers unpaid leave in the case of family medical emergencies. While the vote to override was 258-169, this was well short of the two-thirds needed. Last week, the Senate voted to override the president's veto. Democrats had charged that the Bush veto indicated the president was not sincere in making family values one of his key campaign issues. Compared to school children in most industrialized nations, American students are not doing very well in math, reading, and science. That's according to a new report released by the National Educational Goals Panel. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
The panel, made up of governors, members of Congress, and Bush administration officials, studied three groups of students, low achievers, average, and high achievers, in 8th, 9th, and 10th grade. Researchers found that two-thirds of the kids in the low-achieving group have not mastered simple math concepts such as decimals and fractions. In reading, almost half of the 8th graders in the average group were not able to recite details of what they read. 66% of the highest-achieving 10th graders had trouble with fundamental scientific concepts. South Carolina Governor Carol Campbell is the panel's co-chair.
The reason that they're behind is they spend less time on homework, more time watching television, and their parents do not have as high expectation for their children as the parents of children of other countries do.
Panel members said today's report, the second in a series of 10 designed to measure the nation's progress towards world-class academic standards, was at best discouraging. I'm Claudia Sanchez in Washington.
The government says that sales of new single-family homes fell more than 6% last month, for the biggest drop in 5 months. Sales were down despite some of the lowest interest rates in 20 years. The Commerce Department says that the August sales drop was the largest since March. Sales for July, though, have been revised upward. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. You can imagine how many questions Eva Prokarkova is asked by her passengers. She's a woman who drives a cab at night in New York City. And she's a Czech emigre who left Prague in 1985. Well, now she can tell her passengers she's a novelist. Her road novel, Truck Stop Rainbows, has just been published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. The novel is about a young woman in Prague, overwhelmed by the grayness of life there. She's not interested in marriage or monogamy and decides to sell her body to truckers in order to raise money to buy a wheelchair for a friend with multiple sclerosis. She's depressed watching her girlfriends who have been forced to marry young because they got pregnant and didn't have the courage to face the abortion committee. Prokarkova told me what it was like to go before the abortion committee in Czechoslovakia.
This was terrible. You know, like, let's say you discovered you were pregnant and you had to get a special, you know, go to a special doctor who would write down you are pregnant. And that's, then with this piece of paper, you had to face the abortion committee consisting of three or four severe people who told you, well, you're killing your baby, you should have it, you can study even when you have a baby, and so on and so on. And, well, who's the father? You have to bring, you know, a father. It doesn't really matter who the father is, but you have to bring a father. And then eventually they gave you a stamp, you know, and with this stamp you could go to the hospital and, you know, take care of it.
If you don't mind my asking, did you ever have to go before the abortion committee?
Yeah, I did. It was quite unenjoyable.
And what happened afterwards? Did you decide to go through with the abortion?
Yeah, sure.
How did you start writing? Did you write before you came to the States?
Yes, I did. I did. So, you know, I wrote, like, stories and a few, well, relatively major pieces and stuff when I was very young.
Did you read a lot of underground literature?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did. This was the only thing which was worth reading, as a matter of fact.
How would you get it?
Through friends. You know, there was like a whole network of friends who would give each other books and then borrow it from each other for 1 week or 1 day or whatever, and then you had to read a whole book, a 500-page book overnight so you can give it to someone else in the morning. I guess this was the same thing as in most European countries.
Did that help to make reading very exciting?
Exactly, yeah.
What was the moment that you decided to leave? Was there one moment where you said, okay, this is it, I'm going?
No, I think it was just sort of welling up in me since I was 10 or 12 years old, I guess.
Did you have to sneak out or were you able to get out legally?
Well, I got out legally to Yugoslavia, which was like, well, it was possible. It wasn't easy to get to Yugoslavia, but it was possible. And then I sneaked out to Italy and from Italy to Austria.
How old were you?
22.
How did you end up in the United States?
Well, I applied for going here and I was lucky enough to be accepted.
And did you choose yourself which city you would go to?
Well, I had two choices. I had Idaho or Boston. And first of all, I wanted to go to Idaho. But, you know, they gave me this potato-shaped pin, which really looked awful, and it said, "Welcome to Idaho." And when I saw this pin, I said, "Well, well, I don't think I want to Idaho. So I want to go to Idaho. So I contacted the office again. I said, well, perhaps I could go to Boston, you know. They said, okay, you can go to Boston. So I ended up in Boston.
What scared you off about the potato pen?
Well, I guess it was just this blandness, sort of. Because if there is a... Well, now I was in Idaho and I liked it very much, but I guess it wouldn't have been very good for, you know, as a place to start your life in the United States.
My guest is writer Eva Pekarkova. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, Eva Pekarkova, is a Czech emigre who drives a cab in New York and has just published her first novel, Truck Stop Rainbows. Since 1990, you've been driving a cab in New York. A lot of people think that a woman who drives at night, as you do, would have to be crazy because, well, so many cab drivers in New York have been attacked. And a woman is considered a much more vulnerable target behind the wheel of a taxi. Have you worried about that?
Well, I don't really worry too much about it. Well, I got held up twice. And in fact, the first case when I was held up convinced me that it's not so bad. Because the whole thing took about 30 seconds. The guy put a gun to my stomach, asked me to give him all my money. So I gave him all my money. He took the money and left. So the whole thing took 30 seconds and he didn't try to kill me. It was very professional. So I thought, as long as every robber in New York City is a professional who doesn't kill you when you don't fight back and so on, you know, I'm pretty well off. You know, I can lose a little bit of money once in a while. I don't mind. Well, I do mind, but, you know, it's much better than getting killed.
I don't want to sound like a real downer here, but, you know, you were really lucky to have a criminal who held you up in such a professional way. 30 seconds, gun to your stomach, takes the money, then he's gone.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of really psychotic criminals out there who would be totally unpredictable.
Well, yes.
In 1990, you made up a little, like a little six-page brochure that you called The Book of Eva in Q&A.
Yeah.
And basically it was the questions you were most frequently asked and the answers, questions like, how do you pronounce your name? How long have you been here? Are you afraid being a woman to drive a cab at night?
Yeah.
And you'd sell these books for a dollar each.
Didn't really make much money on them, you know.
Uh-huh.
Because I had to make copies of the original text. So this was like basically to get the people who kept asking too many questions off my neck.
So how would you, did you have them on display in the cab? Or did you, like if somebody started asking you questions, would you say, well, if you really want to know, you can buy my book?
Exactly. Yeah, uh-huh. But I did it in a nice way.
If you really want to know, you could buy my book for a dollar.
Yeah.
Well, I could see why a lot of people didn't buy it with an attitude like that. So how many people bought it, do you think?
Well, at least maybe 100, 120.
Uh-huh, well, it's not too bad.
It's not too bad, and I didn't really offer it to everyone.
Uh-huh. Who would you offer it to?
Well, when someone started asking too many questions, basically, or, you know, like... The thing is, I think I'm basically a fairly nice person, even... though I am driving a cab, but let's say you have 30 passengers in one night and 30 times you have to answer, oh, how do you pronounce your name? How long have you been here? How do you like it here? When did you leave Czechoslovakia? Where do you live? As a woman, aren't you afraid to drive a cab at night? So I was really getting tired and, you know, tired of the whole thing. So in a nice way, I would say, well, you know, I can't really tell you, but... You can buy a book, which will tell you.
Gee, now I understand why people are so annoyed. Oh, the cabbies are so annoyed when I say to them, where are you from? How long have you been here? How do you like New York? How do you like Philadelphia?
Yeah, because you have to answer the same question, you know, 15, 20, 30 times a day. And sometimes you feel that the people are not really interested in you, but they sort of try to hold up a conversation. But, you know, you can have a conversation, but you can talk about different matters.
Your country is going to divide in two. Are you unhappy about that?
Yeah, I don't know where you are turning the knife in my wound, because it just seems so stupid, you know. I was there for 4 months now, discussing this with the Czechs and the Slovaks. I'm Czech personally, but, you know, I don't feel any bad feelings towards the Slovaks at all. In fact, the boyfriend I found now is half Czech and half Slovak. So I don't know where he's going to live, you know, maybe on the border between Bohemia and Slovakia, in between two barbed wire fences.
When was the last time you went back to Czechoslovakia?
Oh, this was this summer. I was there from April to August.
Was it exciting to be back there after the end of communism?
Well, it was very exciting when I was there just after the end of communism in 1989.
Did you ever feel that things were getting so exciting that you wanted to be there, wanted to move back?
Well, precisely this summer I was offered a job for the Czech Secret Service. And I sort of thought this might be very good for me because I would get a lot of material, you know.
Why do you think you were offered a job to serve on the Secret Service?
Well, I guess because I speak some languages and, you know, whatever.
So how come you turned it down?
I didn't turn it down. I said, well, now I'll have to go to America, and if I return, which I will the next spring, we can talk about it if the job is still open.
Eva Pekarkova is the author of the new novel Truck Stop Rainbows. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. A couple of stories tonight. Thousands of Croatians today tried to march back to their home territory in the part of Croatia now controlled by Serbia. The United Nations forces stopped them, and it proved to be a protest march, actually. There is a sentencing trial underway in Atlanta involving the Atlanta branch of an Italian bank, an official accused of fraud in connection with unauthorized loans to Saddam Hussein's Iraq, some of the money used for military matters there. John Nielsen has a report on Bill Clinton's environmental record as governor of Arkansas, and also a bit of satire based on this premise, the last of the Republicans.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Coming up, music inspired by presidential campaigns. First, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz plays some political music from the past. He says a new recording of American campaign music from the 19th century proves that politics was just as dirty 100 years ago as it is today.
Hearing a new recording of 19th century American political music, it occurs to me that this country hasn't had a memorable new campaign song since Irving Berlin wrote I Like Ike. Up until this year, the Democrats have relied on Happy Days Are Here Again as their party anthem. That song was written for a 1930 movie musical called Chasing Rainbows, and FDR appropriated it for his 1932 campaign. It's a significant political statement in itself that this year the Democrats exchanged Happy Days Are Here Again for Fleetwood Mac's Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. And what does it say about the Republicans that while Pat Buchanan and Pat Robertson were bashing gay lifestyles in Houston, the Republican convention theme song, The Best of Times, was from La Cage aux Folles, a Broadway musical about the family values of a homosexual couple? The new album is called Tippecanoe and Tyler II, Politics as Usual in the 1800s, and it's a thoroughly delightful piece of musical and political history. It begins with the campaign of Andrew Jackson, which brass player Jay Crush reminds us in his liner notes, was the first time the American public really got to express its direct voice in a national election. Before that, members of the Electoral College were chosen by state legislatures. The songs continue through the Civil War period and end with the election of Ulysses S. Grant and the American Centennial. Here's the title song, the 1840 campaign song of William Henry Harrison and John Tyler. It must surely have helped them defeat incumbent President Martin Van Buren.
What has caused this great commotion, motion, motion our country through? It is the ball that's rolling on
for Tippecanoe and Tyler too, for Tippecanoe and Tyler too. And with them we'll beat little Van, Van is a used up man. And with them we'll beat little Van.
I'm happy to report that some of these old songs are as scurrilous as politics ever gets. This one is called Buck's Private Confession Publicly Revealed. It's from the 1856 election campaign and puts some nasty words about Democratic candidate James Buchanan into his own mouth. Fortunately, negative campaigning doesn't always work. Buchanan won. He was our only bachelor president. The marvelous folk singer Linda Russell is the satirical voice of Buchanan. Rudolph Palmer is the cheery forte pianist.
Oh, if I thought that I had got one drop of Democrat's blood, my jugular vein I'd rip in twain and spill the filthy flood.
Now don't let that annoy you, we say, oh, buffer, stop. If they boiled you down in a Chandler's hat, they couldn't raise a drop.
I don't believe in marriage, a curse on wives and weans. I love myself too much to share with them my pork and beans.
But don't let that annoy you, a cuckold he was born. And since he left his federal wife, hasn't she given him a horn?
Maybe Buchanan won because his own campaign song was written by a great songwriter, Stephen Foster, who was Buchanan's brother's wife's brother. Some of the songs here are also about serious issues: abolition of slavery, universal suffrage, national unity, and they enrich this album. Along with the satirical and the celebratory, there are several dirges for presidents who died in office. The most moving, appropriately, is President Lincoln's Funeral March, composed by T.M. Brown. Singing by Linda Russell, tenors Patrick Romano and Frederick Urry, and bass baritone John Ostendorf is thoroughly idiomatic, not at all operatic. The five members of the Chestnut Brass Company played their keyed bugles, cornopians, ophicleides, and sax horns with brilliant precision and energy. Maybe all that Bill Clinton or George Bush really needs now is a great campaign song. Maybe not.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. We congratulate him on just having won the 1992 Radio and TV Award from the international music fraternity Sigma Alpha Iota. Well, now we fast forward to the political present with our rock critic Ken Tucker. There's a new rap song out, and thanks to digital audio technology, the lead singer is President Bush.
I will not raise the taxes on the working man and woman of this country. Read my lips. No new taxes. Read my lips. No new taxes. Read my lips. No new taxes.
current presidential campaign hasn't yet yielded the sort of pop music epiphany that rock fans crave. There's been nothing like Ronald Reagan's shameless appropriation of Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA in 1984, or Jimmy Carter's cozying up to Bob Dylan and Willie Nelson in, when was the last time there was a Democrat in the White House? This year, the candidates are agreeing on things entirely too much. The bashing of Ice-T and Sister Souljah was a spectacle of bipartisan bullying, for example. And the tastes of both George Bush and Bill Clinton seem mired in the 70s. Bill and Hillary and Al and Tipper boogied to middle-period Fleetwood Mac at the Democratic convention, while Tanya Tucker sang the national anthem for the Republicans 20 years after her first big hit, the gleefully anti-family-valued Will You Lay With Me in a Field of Stone. For its part, the pop music industry has been blandly noncommittal, at least in the area of musical endorsements. How nice it is, therefore, to hear a one-sided, straightforwardly mean-spirited piece of 1992 music.
My stand is this. I oppose abortion. I oppose federal funding of abortion. Except in the case of rape, incest, and the life of the mother, I do not favor repeal of the Constitution in that regard.
What you're saying is this shows that I supported federal funding if there was rape or incest, I think. And I don't recall that, but if it's there, fine. That's not my position now. And I don't recall it as being my position then.
I am firmly positioned in favor of, overturn of Roe Wade, and that's my position, and I'm not going to change that position.
You know, there has been, I have to make a confession, an evolution in my position.
Come on, Michael, give us a break there.
Read My Lips catches the president in contradictions by editing together clashing statements he's made about subjects such as the economy, abortion, and the Watergate and Iran-Contra scandals. Read My Lips is credited to 1,000 points of night, which is actually Don Was, one of the leaders of Was Not Was and producer of the last two Bonnie Raitt albums, along with a few freelance co-conspirators. Read My Lips fails as first-rate political pop because the music behind Bush's words just isn't exciting enough. It's a rather anonymous funk groove. But at least it opens the door. It's high time for some rocker, rapper, or country singer to either top Read My Lips for anti-Bush invective or to dissect Clinton with just as much rancor.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Sue Spolin and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. I'm Terry Gross.
People said to me the other day, do you think the president knew about Watergate? I said, he didn't know about Watergate. They said, how do you know? I said, because I believe the president and I believe in the presidency.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
The bright flash of light Terry Tempest Williams saw as a child was a nuclear bomb blast. Growing up in Utah, she lived close to several nuclear tests. She thinks it's no coincidence that 7 women in her family have had breast cancer. On the next Fresh Air, Williams reads from her memoir about her mother's death. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.